Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Sarah Elder. Sarah is an advanced clinical practice dietitian in eating disorders. She works both in the NHS and through her private practice to support clients to help them navigate the complex world of nutrition and develop a healthier relationship with food. Sarah also provides educational sessions for healthcare professionals to upskill them in areas of eating disorders and nutrition. In this week's podcast, we speak all about the role of an eating disorder dietitian and how this can differ to mainstream nutrition. And we also speak about gastrointestinal issues that people may face in recovery from an eating disorder and how a dietitian can work to support their client that is going through this challenge. Well, Sarah, it's so lovely to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
How are you doing this morning?
I'm good, thank you. Doing really good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I just said to my partner, I'm not very happy about the temperature drop. I thought that summer was coming and I'm now sat here literally with a hot water bottle and my blanket.
No, that's not good. I should probably not mention my trip to Greece then, should I?
Yeah, I do not want to know about that. Thank you very much. Fantastic. So would you like to introduce yourself for the listeners?
Yes, of course. So my name is Sarah Elder. I am an eating disorders dietitian and also have trained in advanced clinical practice as well. So I currently work in the NHS, but I also work privately as well. And I run a company that offers webinars and workshops for eating disorder health professionals to upskill themselves around nutrition, but also to kind of stay within their scope of practice as well. So yeah, that's me.
Fantastic. That sounds amazing. And I love the work that you do. And I'm very glad that I get to do some work with you. I was listening to the ADHD Chatter podcast the other day, and Alex Partridge asked this question as the first question. I thought that'd be a really good question to ask Sarah to kind of open things up. With the work that you do, what is your mission?
Great question.
Wasn't it? I was listening love and I was this. Like, this would be great on Monday.
Yes, love this. So I guess my mission, and maybe I should put this on the website actually. So my mission is to make sure that every nutrition professional working in eating disorders has accessible and also kind of up-to-date information around eating disorders and nutrition, so that the right information is being used within clinical practice, but also that the right information is getting to the clients that people are working with if that's something that they want to find out more about. So for me, that's kind of like my business mission, if that makes sense. And I guess from a personal kind of mission, because I guess it's slightly two different things.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess from a personal mission, I think because I've sat in that position where I was very new into eating disorders, we hadn't done a lot about it at kind of university. Thankfully, I had a brilliant tutor who was really interested in eating disorders and brought it into the curriculum, even though it wasn't on the national curriculum as such at that time, is that I want to kind of make sure that nobody feels in the position that I maybe felt in when I first started, where I felt like, I don't know if I'm doing this right. Who else can I talk to about this? Like, who else can I help? And that just that position that you sit in being like, am I doing enough? Am I doing the right thing? Is this actually helpful? Is it not? And thankfully, I had loads of support at that time, but it still sits with you because there was nothing else that I could go to. And when you said, oh, can I go on some training? Oh, there's no training. This is kind of what this is what you do. There's like a group meeting once every few months, or there's kind of like a conference once every year. Wow. And it just felt like everything you went to, it was to do with eating disorders, but not to do with nutrition and not to do with your role. Mm. So for me, I guess the personal side of that is I don't want anybody to feel in that position where they maybe aren't feeling supported or they don't have a place to go to get what they need to kind of make sure that they feel safe and comfortable in the role that they're having. And things have really come on. There's lots of places that do offer kind of support around that. But I just remember at that time, it just wasn't there when I first started.
Yeah. No, I think it's fantastic the work that you do, and it's so important, I think, that professionals that are working in nutrition do have any understanding of eating disorders. And I'm sure we'll come on to this as we talk, but you know, it's a, from my perspective, it feels like a very different way to approach nutrition compared to maybe if you're a dietitian, you know, working with somebody and you're trying to improve their kind of health or wellness or what have you, and you might be looking at different food groups and educating them on that. And obviously that's a part of the work that you do as an eating disorder dietitian, but in my experience I didn't need that help and support when I was struggling, because I knew all of that from doing my own research and that obsessionality. What I needed was help with my relationship with food and changing that part.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, I guess what we tend to see, and I know definitely what I saw, was that in your general kind of nutrition clinics there might be that nutrition education, and I guess when you think about nutrition education, it's here's some information about nutrition, how does that apply to you? Whereas we're actually instead, we need to be looking at our kind of psychoeducation, where somebody's thinking about, what are my goals, what are my values, what do I want my life to look like? Okay, well, how can nutrition support me to get there? And it's kind of linking the nutrition to somebody's kind of values and what they're wanting out of life. And I guess with psychoeducation, there needs to be that moment where someone goes, that's it. So with just general nutrition information, say you're talking about salt, so you might be given all the information about salt, why it impacts our body, why it does this, why it does the other. Whereas psychoeducation, it would be more around thinking about, okay, well, how does this link, how does this salt link with your values, how does that link with what you're wanting out of your long-term life, how does that information around salt make you feel, how does that information about salt make you either kind of change what you're eating, how does that affect your relationship with food? That's what we do in kind of eating disorder treatment. And that's really what we want all eating disorder and kind of nutrition, kind of health professionals and dietitians to be able to do, to kind of think about how nutrition fits into somebody's life and into their values. And it sounds like from what you've just shared there, that you had this information, you had it already. And I think we need to build on that with people and say, right, you've got this information. Brilliant. Is it correct to start off with? If it's not, why might it not be quite correct? But also, does it apply to you? And does it matter when we're kind of looking at your long-term values?
I think that's such a fantastic example, and I really like how you kind of demonstrated the differences in how you might have that communication. Sorry, one second. Partner's slamming about. Say, please can we be quiet? Apologies for that. Yeah, I really like that example that you gave, because I think that was such a key thing that I found. You know, I didn't need to be told how many carbs to be having or how much fat. I mean, probably did need to be told that information, but I could have told you that. And it was, you so beautifully put, it was more exploring my relationship with that. Like, you know, I knew how much I knew that I needed to be having more fat, but why wasn't I allowing myself to have fat, rather than being told maybe those different things? Is there anything else that's particularly different when you're working as an eating disorder dietitian compared to, you know, maybe a dietitian in just a standard nutrition clinic that you've experienced?
I think it's really tricky, I think, for myself, because I didn't spend that much time in a general clinic, shall we say. But I did spend that time, and I obviously kind of had placements and things like that in general clinics, but I pretty much went into mental health. And I think that the reason kind of for that was because I liked the way in which the mental health things worked. I liked the psychological side of things, and I liked developing those kind of relationships and that therapeutic alliance with people, whereas you don't really get that in other clinical settings as much. You do in some, but some of them you don't. And I think what I found really tricky was that you'd see someone a few times and then you'd never see them again. And it's really hard to build that relationship and actually support them to make some of those changes. Because when you think about behavior change, you don't just go to a clinic appointment, you talk about it, and then you put it into place. It actually takes a long time to make some of those changes. And we're kind of battled with a lot, aren't we, around kind of social media, where people are giving you these instant fixes. And then you're there as kind of like a nutrition professional saying, well, actually, this takes a while for you to kind of really make changes and I guess, for them to be long-term and for them to be lifelong. But people are just jumping onto kind of the stuff that they're seeing on social media, being like, oh, well, actually, I can get a quick fix by doing X, Y, and Z. And I think some of the work with clients with eating disorders, I think I just found that something in it just clicked for me. I got it. And I don't know what that is. And I don't know how to explain that to someone, but I just got it. And I thought, do you know what? I think I can support people here. I think that this is a place where I want to work. I don't want work to feel like work, if that makes sense. And actually, this doesn't feel like work to me. I don't go into like work on the morning and be like, oh, these are all the tasks I've got to do today. It's okay, how can I support somebody today? What does that look like? What are we going to do that that person needs? And yeah, there's a few odd tasks that I need to do, but it doesn't feel like it's a task and that it's a chore. It feels like, okay, I really enjoy this. Like, in a way that I want to help and support people because I like the fact that I know that in X number of months time, their life is going to be better for them. It's not for me. It's not for the rest of the team. It's for them. And I don't know, it's just something clicked. And I think that's where we find it really difficult when kind of you're saying to people, oh, well, working with eating disorder clients is different from working with kind of your general nutrition clients. And it's really hard to explain what it is that's different. But I think it's the psychological input. I think it's the fact that you're seeing people for a lot longer, you're developing those therapeutic alliances, you're unpicking and helping people develop skills for hopefully the rest of their life. And I guess what we do see is that we see that there's a much greater focus on behavior change, a much greater focus on managing anxiety, supporting body image distress, developing those healthy relationships with food, and managing trauma as well. So there's lots of things that go into that that we are doing on a really, really regular basis that maybe in some other areas of kind of nutrition, it's seen as, oh, this is quite new, especially the stuff around kind of what I've seen more recently is really coming through around trauma-informed nutrition approaches. And that's coming through now. And I'm thinking, hang on a minute, we've been doing this for years in eating disorders. But everybody else is starting to realize, oh, okay, we need to be aware of these things because it does affect people's relationships with food and it does affect their mental health and how mental health can then affect their kind of nutrition and overall health as well. Those things we've always been doing in kind of eating disorder treatment.
What do you mean by trauma-informed nutrition? Is that what you said?
Yes, trauma-informed nutrition. So this is kind of quite a new phrase that is kind of coming about. And it's a really interesting one because what we're kind of seeing is that depending on people's history, it may well be that there's been a significant amount of trauma within their life. And I guess what we've kind of seen previously is that people are aware of that trauma, but aren't really sure how it relates to them in the nutrition world. But what we're kind of seeing now and what is kind of coming through and where the research is kind of taking us and what we need to be bringing into our practice is thinking about this trauma-informed kind of nutritional care, that we're aware of the trauma and we're making sure that we're not repeating any trauma for people and that we're being really inclusive in terms of our care. So if we take bulimia nervosa, for example, if someone's got a diagnosis of bulimia nervosa, what the research is telling us, and obviously every case is individual, that there is a high likelihood that that person has experienced a level of trauma within their life. So when we think about the nutrition work, we need to be aware of that trauma and think about what can I do to make sure that I'm creating a safe and secure place within the kind of the nutrition appointment. What is it that I'm doing to make sure that everything is kind of transparent and trustworthy? And it might be just simple as, well, do you know what? I don't know the answer to that, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to get back to you about it. It might be that if we do something wrong, then we need to let them know about it, that kind of duty of candor. It's simple things that we should be doing already, but it's making sure that we're always doing it as health professionals. There's things that kind of that you might think about empowerment, voice, and choice as well. So really making sure that you're giving opportunities all of the time for people, for them to make sure that they feel empowered and make sure that they've got a voice within their treatment and that they've got choice within that kind of nutritional care, making sure that everything's really collaborative, bringing in peer support where possible as well, and actually recognizing that people need communities and to meet with other people that might have gone through an experience. Other people might not want that, and that's absolutely fine, and that's where that kind of collaboration comes in. So what we're looking at, and they're just kind of a few examples that we should be doing anyway, and to be honest, when I looked at a lot of the trauma-informed nutrition stuff, I just thought, if people aren't doing this, then what have they been doing? But I think what they've tried to do is collate all of that and put it into almost a bit of a framework for people to be able to follow to make sure that they are delivering something like an intervention or a review, whatever that is, in terms of their nutrition, and making sure that they are not causing any further trauma to that individual. And I think what I found really interesting about this when I kind of was looking into it was that I think we've been doing this in eating disorders care, in terms of definitely the teams that I've worked into, that we've made sure that we are trauma informed. However, I can also see where things haven't been trauma informed and it's been, here's a very rigid plan, this is what you need to do. And kind of there's no movement from kind of that plan. So I think that we need to make sure that we are aware of that in trauma-informed nutritional care. Does that make a little bit of sense?
Definitely. And I mean, I think I agree with you in that that feels to me like it should just be part of care anyway. And so, like you say, if it's not, then kind of what are people doing? But I'm really glad that there's that awareness in terms of, because I do think that from my perspective, and I mean, I'm not, you know, a qualified health professional, this is purely just from like my reading and stuff, but I do think that the experience of going through an eating disorder is traumatic. And often, fortunately, I haven't experienced this myself, but I've spoken to a lot of people who, when they've then gone through treatment or recovery, they've then experienced trauma through that. And whether that is, you know, different therapeutic models, or a lot of people say it in terms of the feeding process, you know, that can be a very traumatic experience. So I think having this understanding and also being aware of, you know, people's previous trauma, whatever that may look like, that feels essential to care, to ensure, as you said, that that's not happening again, and that actually we're not giving people more trauma through the treatment process. Because ultimately, you know, recovery and treatment can be really difficult and be really challenging, but you don't want to worsen somebody's experiences, even if you know, you need to put things in place, because they're in quite a vulnerable position in terms of, you know, their physical health.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think sometimes kind of what we find is that, like you say, people are kind of going through treatment, but they're being told, oh, there isn't a choice around that, or, well, this is the way that we do it, so we need to keep going. And I think one of the things that I'm very conscious of is the stuff around kind of gut health. And for years and years, we were always told, in terms of, if you're going to get gut symptoms, you need to just deal with them and kind of get on with that. But actually now there's so much research that's now starting to come through, and there isn't a specific pathway to follow, but there's lots of research that is helping us to kind of think about, right, well, is there something that we could do with the food? Is there something possibly that we could do around kind of somatics and yoga? Is there something that we can do around kind of the gut-brain connection? There's lots of opportunities there. Yes, we don't have a pathway. Yes, it's not kind of in that place where there's this nice guidelines that tells us what we need to be doing. But what it is doing is it's opening up that opportunity to say, hang on a minute, we've always been told there isn't anything that you can do, but actually, is there something that we could just bring into your care to minimize that distress that you're facing? So I think they're the things that we need to be a lot more mindful of, just to make sure that we're up to date as health professionals with all of that evidence base, and that we can offer then people different options, and they can have a little think about, oh, okay, well, I think I could try that, or I could give that a go. And making sure that also as health professionals, again, on the gastro front, is that we're not restricting people in any way around kind of, I guess, around food, because we see it quite a lot that people might have disordered eating and go into gastro clinics and put on like a FODMAP diet or a very specific kind of diets in another way because they're worried that there might be a lactose or something like that. Well, actually, have we ruled other things out, and what can we do to maybe add into the diet, or can we do some things before we have to get to a very restrictive diet? So again, it's that side of things, because actually if we're providing another restrictive diet on top of what is possibly already a restrictive diet, that we are causing some trauma there for people. Yeah. Because we're taking out foods that they can manage or that they feel safe with. Mm. So there's lots of different ways to think about that kind of trauma-informed nutrition. But I think it's a really interesting and really important area that we are kind of exploring, I guess, as a whole profession around nutrition and dietetics.
Yeah, I'm not laughing at your comment about the low FODMAP diet. I was laughing because that was exactly my experience.
Oh, was it?
Because okay. I think I've spoken about this on the podcast before, so apologies if listeners have heard this already. But yeah, so when this was before my most recent relapse, this was a fair few years ago, and I was really struggling with IBS.
Mm.
I still really struggle with IBS. I think, unfortunately, that is a challenge of 14 years of an eating disorder, but it's getting better, which is good. But yeah, I went to the doctor and they said, something that we'll try is the low FODMAP diet. And I said, oh, I actually have, you know, prior history of anorexia, so I don't know how comfortable I'd feel doing the low FODMAP diet. Bearing in mind, when you do the low FODMAP diet, as I'm sure you are aware, you are supposed to do that for not forever. And also you should do it under the assistance of a dietitian or nutritionist because of the restrictive element of it. Mm-hmm. And he said, don't worry, because the foods that you have to restrict on the low FODMAP diet are actually foods that people with eating disorders are really comfortable with. So it's like vegetables and stuff like that. I was just sat there and I didn't quite know what to say. I was like, okay, firstly, you've made a massive assumption there regarding what food somebody with an eating disorder is comfortable with. But secondly, does that therefore mean that you're telling me that the foods I'm comfortable with, you're going to now ask me to restrict? So you're actually making the situation like much worse.
Mm.
And so I said to him, I was like, oh, I'm really sorry. I don't actually think that that would be appropriate for me.
Mm.
So I don't think that that's something I want to try. But I think it's very dangerous because, you know, my gastro symptoms after this relapse, when I was weight restoring and then, you know, bringing different foods into my diet and everything, it has been horrific. And I think it's one of those things that, you know, I think what you said about giving people more information of like different things to try and stuff is fantastic. But I think actually also having open dialogue about the intensity and severity of how the gastro symptoms can be, because I have, that's one thing that has really, like I would say, halted my recovery was because you eat something and the biggest fear is that you're going to gain weight. And it isn't that you've gained weight, because you can't gain weight instantly after a meal. But when your clothes feel so tight and you're bloated and you feel just so much larger because of the impact that the food has had on you, mentally that messed with me so much. And I was vegetarian, which a lot of that I've now, you know, after time come to realize was like, it was to restrict. It wasn't the environmental impact that I was saying. And actually what I've decided to do is, you know, be environmentally conscious in other ways, because therefore I'm not restricting my food. But lately I've been introducing more meat into my diet to kind of, you know, practice eating those foods, and because it's been a bit scary. And again, the gastro symptoms have just been awful because I've not eaten meat for like 3 years. And, you know, my partner was like, oh, Hannah, you're just being, you know, just being dramatic. I was like, no, genuinely, like this is actually quite painful. But it's really difficult mentally, because you're like, I know that I'm doing this because I want to have a healthier relationship with food, but my body is not happy with that. So you can then use that as an excuse of, oh, well, I can't eat that food because my body doesn't respond well to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's such a difficult place to sit as kind of a health professional, because you're saying, actually, we need to expand these foods. But then that can be causing pain. And then that can then be a barrier for someone saying, oh, I can't do this. And what's really interesting, what you mentioned there, and and obviously we're not in a clinic appointment, so tell me to be quiet if you want to. But also what I'd be exploring there is, you've mentioned you're such a concern around kind of having that food, and wondering where someone's anxiety level would be, and wondering then about that gut brain connection. And actually, it's, yes, it's the digestive system, but also how much can we do around that anxiety as well, and that worry and that intense fear. And I think this is where I really think that we need to be aware of what research is out there, to look at that as a whole picture, that we can't just go in and say, let's just eat meat. It needs to be, okay, we're trying a new food. How are we working with psychology and OT to be able to manage this? Are we looking at all different angles here in terms of your fear and your anxiety and your kind of concerns around this? It's not just about the meat here, and what else can we be doing? And I think that's what we need to get to, a place to kind of think about that. In terms of nutrition professionals, people need to move away from, well, the nutrition professionals provide a meal plan and then off they go, or the nutritionist or the dietitian gets rolled in when you're not gaining weight. That's not actually what we're about. And I think that there's so much, and I'll take your experience here as well, because I think your experience would be valid. But I know what I've found from people is that they've said that they're so fearful of the nutritionist or the dietitian, because they know that when they need to see them, it's because they've got to increase their weight. And actually, what else can we be doing outside of that? And for me, that just brings more trauma in, because you're just getting wheeled in. It's not great for the nutritionist or the dietitian that's just getting wheeled in to say, oh, here you go, you need to wave a magic wand and increase this person's diet. But also, it's not great for that person, because the fear that must be associated with that. Well, there's lots of other things that we can be doing and we can be supporting with, expanding of foods, thinking about anxiety around foods, working with kind of psychology and OT to be able to manage that, thinking about how do we work with our prescribing colleagues to be able to think about, are there any medications there? Like, what are we doing with our nursing teams? Well, how can we make this experience a little bit better? And actually, sometimes you see the dietitian because they want to come in and they want to have a chat with you and they want to see how you're going, and actually they want to know whether you got back to horse riding this week, or did you manage to go and do kind of the artwork that you wanted to do. Like, that we want to know about those things. We're interested. We want to see your progress. It's not just about, oh, okay, you're seeing me because we need to increase your diet. So I think we need to be aware of that as well.
Yeah, that was actually going to be one of my questions to you, was, you know, when you were talking about that trauma-informed aspect, and it sounded very kind of, you know, almost, yeah, I guess therapeutic, and like almost the work that you would maybe be doing with your psychologist or your therapist. And it's really interesting what you say about, you know, like the dietitian gets rolled in when you're not gaining weight, because that was absolutely my experience. Like, the only time I didn't have like regular meetings with the dietitian, the time that the dietitian came along was when my meal plan needed upping because I wasn't gaining weight. I mean, this was 14 years ago, so I really, really hope that things have moved on. But I remember sitting there and, like, you know, fundamentally, my family lifestyle was, we ate healthily, you know, it was, you'd have, you know, a chocolate bar at the weekend or something, but we didn't have like lots of snacks like that in the house. And I remember sitting there and the dietitian said that I had to have like chocolate based cereal for breakfast, a chocolate bar for my snack, and then I had to have like sandwich and crisps, what have you. And it was just all foods that weren't in my household. And I remember sitting there thinking, okay, so I've now got to do all of this work, this terrifying work. I've got to up my meal plan, but I'm also feeling alienated in my household because the foods that you're asking me to eat, you know, my parents ate perfectly well. You know, they were very healthy individuals, but just the kind of foods that they were asking me to eat weren't foods that we had in our family. So there was no way of, there's no like integration into my life. It was just like, this is what you're going to have to eat. And I feel like such a big role as a dietitian is to understand someone's lifestyle. And it is to, you know, obviously you're going to be asking them to incorporate more foods. And, you know, you could sit there and think, well, did your family need to start maybe being more open with their diet and stuff? But yeah, I think that in a sense is so important. So seeing it from that that holistic view, that whole mm-hmm. picture. And like you say, working with all the different other healthcare professionals, you know, oh, this happened in therapy this week, this could be impacting her meal plan. Or as you said mm-hmm. before, you know, I think the food is just one element, the meal plan is one element, but actually as a dietitian or nutritionist, it's so important to see that bigger picture of how this is integrating into somebody's whole recovery rather than just have they upped their meal plan.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that's how I was trained, in terms of being able to make sure that you're integrating everything of that person into that plan, so that plan is theirs. Yes, the outcome, for example, might be that we need to increase that nutrition, but it actually might be we need to increase energy, but maybe do we need to increase protein? Do we need to reduce down fiber? What is it that needs to be done to support that individual, but what feels safe and what feels possible for them at the point in which they're at in terms of their care? And I think that I know lots of people get kind of standard meal plans and things like that. And I think that a standard meal plan for me tells you what you're eating at every single point of the day. And actually, like you say, they might not come into your household. And I think standard meal plans are great for ideas. And it might be like, look, this is what we like, what we might recommend for someone over X amount of days. What in there feels possible for you? What doesn't? Can you tell me about that? Why might that be? And let's unpick that together. Okay, can we take some ideas out of this? But what ideas have you got of your own? And that's what we need to be doing. So I think for me, meal plans are a starting point and shouldn't be a standard. But I do know that in some places that you're kind of given, oh, here's a meal plan. You still get that online, don't you? You sign up for something and someone's like, oh, here's a standard meal plan. We've individualized it to you. I don't think you have. I think that's just a standard meal plan. And I think there might be common themes across kind of people's meal plans and things, but realistically, it needs to be tailored to you and it needs to be individual to you.
Yeah. And actually, yeah, that raises such a good point in terms of if someone, I guess, you know, you give them a meal plan, if they do have, you know, like thoughts about, oh, well, that's not a food that's in my household, let's take the chocolate-based cereal for me. Mm-hmm. Then you could explore that and be like, okay, like, why does that feel inaccessible to you? Is it fear? Is it because of the connotations associated with that? Or is it just not a food that you want to have? But, you know, if you were given it, you know, mm-hmm. what kind of emotions would come up for you? I feel like that is a much better approach rather than just giving you a meal plan, sending you off and then realizing, oh, well, they've not eaten for a week because those foods didn't feel possible to get through.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that exactly what you've said there is looking at that bigger picture. And I think that with foods, that there are going to be foods that people bring into their diet that they haven't had for a while or that might not be the norm in their household. But some foods we have to do just to begin with, and just because it might feel better in terms of, I don't know, we'll take the chocolate cereal, for example. Obviously, I don't know the ins and outs of it and the details, but it might be that for someone, it might be that having a chocolate cereal feels much more accessible than having to do something else, like, mm-hmm. I don't know, a topping of nuts, for example. So that might be a chocolate cereal that doesn't happen to be within the household, and that's fine. But for now, we've got to have that because that's mm-hmm. part of recovery. And then it's another food that at a later point, you can make a decision personally around, do I fancy a chocolate cereal? If I do, I know I can have it. Yeah. If I don't fancy a chocolate cereal, that's fine. It doesn't matter. If the chocolate cereal is the only thing left in the house that day, it's not going to be nothing or a chocolate cereal. It's not going to be nothing. Sorry. You know that you can then have the chocolate cereal. So I think it's about that, isn't it? It's about that bigger picture, being able to kind of think a little bit around these foods on in recovery, depending what kind of you pick and what that meal plan looks like. That isn't your meal plan forever. Mm-hmm. That is just, we need to support you right now with foods that feel, yes, a little bit out of your comfort zone, but also feel safe enough to be able to manage, and then expand on that. So I think you're absolutely right when you're saying that we need to look at everybody as an individual, because we do, because everybody is an individual. But we also need to unpick, why is it, again, I'll come back to the chocolate cereal, why is it that chocolate cereal just doesn't feel possible right now? They're the conversations that we need to be having. And it might feel that going in with a meal plan, here it is, off you go, might feel like, oh, okay, well, that was just quick and easy, but we haven't got enough time to be seeing everybody. But actually, the result then is, like you said, Hannah, that person doesn't eat for a week because it includes foods that just are too stressful for them. You're better off spending an hour doing a meal planning session with someone, building that relationship, getting to know them, finding out what feels possible, and doing that a few times rather than giving a meal plan and then the physical health declining. So it's got to be that, it's got to be that middle ground.
Something else just popped into my head as well as you were talking is, you know, thinking about like culturally appropriate meal plans. Yes. As well, like if someone comes in and, you know, you're asking them to eat something that is not part of their culture and it's not something that they've had experience of, it's so common for like sandwich and crisps to be on the meal plan. Well, if you come from somewhere that sandwich and crisps isn't a food that's eaten, and actually it's your family joined together and they all have curry and rice or, you know, whatever it is, for you to then have to sit there with a sandwich and crisps, you're going to feel, as I was saying before, like completely alienated. And I think, you know, going back to that whole like trauma-informed care piece, that is an element of it, of like, you know, how can you help support someone to feel more integrated into their community through their food rather than feeling pushed out because they've got this meal plan that doesn't align with anybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what's so important about getting to know people, find out what's normalized for them in terms of that family food. What did things look like before the eating disorder came about? And we use a lot something called the Real Food Guide. The Real Food Pyramid, sorry, the Real Food Pyramid, which basically outlines kind of the regular kind of nutrition, what foods you might have more often, what foods might be kind of like filler foods, what are fun foods. And it's a great resource and it comes from Australia. However, it contains Australian food. And what I think is really interesting about that is that the comparison between Australia and UK food. But then when you're looking at that and having to use that in clinic, it's not culturally appropriate for a lot of people. So we did a webinar, it must have been a few years ago now, with Beth, who is the ED dietitian on Instagram. And we were talking about it being culturally appropriate or not. And we actually said, well, I wonder whether you could almost do like an outline of the real food pyramid without any foods in. And that'd be part of somebody's kind of initial assessment or at some point to actually fill that in and say, okay, within your household, what would be the typical carbohydrates that you'd have? What would be the typical proteins? What are the typical kind of fats? What are the typical kind of like filler type foods that you would have? And use that information to find out kind of what was pre-eating disorder.
Yeah.
What is maybe being influenced by the eating disorder? And are there things that you're not having, but you'd like to be able to have as well? And then that real food pyramid then ends up becoming that individual kind of food pyramid for that person to be able to build meals from. And that felt, I mean, that kind of just came out of us having a bit of a discussion within one of the webinars. And it felt much more culturally appropriate because even in different kind of aspect, in different places of the UK, you're going to have things that are kind of specific to maybe that area. And I think that we have to include those like local options within our kind of, within our dietary plan and what's normal for those kind of people so that are living in that area. So we need to really, really take that on, and that has to be part of a dietetic appointment. And then to add to that, people's allergies, tolerances, you've got all of that, which would always be part of a standard appointment anyway. But I just think we need to move away from everyone being given, it's a standard meal plan, this is what you need to follow, this is what it looks like.
I mean, I really like what you said, like it's called like the real food guide or what have you. It's not very real if it's not actually appropriate to use, you know. So that made me giggle. I also liked what you said about thinking about pre-eating disorder, you know, what were your eating habits, what foods kind of were you eating and stuff like that. And I think that was my biggest reflection when I was thinking about being vegetarian or not. It was like that has come on since the eating disorder. And, you know, like maybe once I've tried a bit of meat and integrated it, I might realize actually it's not really my jam. And I do want to go back to being vegetarian, but I was sitting uncomfortably with that, thinking I think there's still a restrictive element. And it's so hard, but I think that that's a big part of when you're reestablishing your relationship with food and adding foods back in is that honesty piece of really having to say to yourself, why is it that I'm not eating this food? You know, is it fear? Is it the kind of symptoms that I have from it? But, you know, are these symptoms that I'm having because I've not eaten it for 2 years? Or am I actually, you know, do I have an intolerance or an allergy? So I really like that thought about thinking about before the eating disorder. to then, you know, make a decision moving forwards.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think that we see this a lot in kind of when I work with underings, is that people forget what the pre-eating disorder looks like, and that the whole family's diet get morphed into what the eating disorder wants. And then people are like, oh yeah, we don't have those in the house. And then think, oh, actually, a few years ago, we did have those in the house. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to kind of explore that. And it takes a bit of time, and it takes a lot of kind of that therapeutic alliance and getting to know your care team before you can share some of those things. Because I think sometimes people go in that initial appointment and are faced with, you're vegetarian. Well, is that because of the eating disorder? No. Yeah. Like, I think it's really inappropriate to necessarily ask that. It might be like you ask really gently around, how long have you been vegetarian for? What influenced that? And then, okay. And then we move on. And then actually, as someone's treatment kind of goes on, like you say, it might be that you just explore that a little bit more, because I don't think someone's going to be able to have that ability necessarily. They might do, but not always have that ability to actually say to you kind of, oh, okay, I met you 10 minutes ago and I'm going to tell you that this, that and the other is all because of my eating disorder. My eating disorder is going to be screaming at them in your kind of initial assessment. So I think being able to revisit some of these things is really helpful.
Yeah. And I think also you have your guard up so much. I mean, I've definitely found that when I first started therapy and treatment, it was like, no. Like, this is my dirty little secret. This is my, like, it's me and the eating disorder. I don't possibly want anybody else to know about all these behaviours and what have you. And it takes time to build that trust with somebody to share it. So if you dive on in and say, yeah, well, you're only vegetarian because of your eating disorder, you know, and accuse someone in that way, it's like, whoa, okay, like, we've just destroyed all the trust. That's going to take a long time to rebuild. So thank you so much, Sarah. It's been such an interesting chat with you, and we've gone in all different directions, which I didn't expect, but I absolutely love that. Where can people go to find out more about you and the webinars and all the services that you provide?
So I am on Instagram at Sarah Elder Nutrition, and then our website is saraheldernutrition.co.uk. I do dabble a little bit in called X now, isn't it, and Threads. Ooh. But not very often at all. I would say LinkedIn, but again, yeah, not great on it, but maybe it's something that I'll have a little look at a later point. So the main one to Instagram and our website.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much. Honestly, been such a pleasure to chat to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.